This is Robert Greenall. This is Robert Greenall. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We greatly appreciate you taking time to join us and our guest today for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with that esteemed cohort that is joining us live, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. That's the perfect place during the course of the show if you have some observations you wanted to share or even some questions you would like for us to address to our guests during the course of the show. We'll be monitoring that from beginning to end, and we'd be glad to bring in your good ideas as the conversation moves forward. Likewise, if halfway through the show you find you got to run off and take care of some stuff to get ready for the holiday season, or if you decide that, hey, I've missed a few mid-rats down the road, if you haven't already, go ahead and subscribe to the free podcast. You'll find it on iTunes, Stitcher, or any of those aggregators where you get your podcast from. That way we'll be waiting for you at a time best to your convenience. And with that intro done, let's go ahead and dive into today's show. And as most of my regular listeners here, our regular listeners here on Midrat know, when you look at the influence and responsibilities of a naval power, most reviews of history and also common practice shows that the most fundamental role of a major power's naval forces is to show the flag, to have a presence, to message in a way only a few thousand tons of national sovereignty can do. And the world's premier naval power, at whatever time in history you have, finds that comes with it additional responsibilities, and that is command of the seas. And as we face an accelerating China at sea for the People's Republic of China, do we need to have a fundamental look at the fundamentals and how we maintain, equip, train, and get our Navy ready to perform its duties in support of our nation's interest. And our guest today is returning to Midrat to talk about this and more, and we're going to use his recent article from the December of this year, Naval Institute Proceedings. His article is titled, Think Differently About Naval Presence. Captain Barney Ruble, welcome back to Midrat.
Great to be here, Sal.
Well, again, for the listener, if he sounds like he's talking from a truck in a parking lot somewhere in Texas, that's pretty close to what's going on here. But we've got good audio, and this is going to be a great hour. And I'll go ahead and put a link to the article in the chat room. It's also linked up on the show page. But early on in the article, Barney, you brought up a name that I was like, I know this guy, and most everybody does. That was Vice Admiral Stansfield Turner. And you brought up an article that he wrote back in 1974, Missions of the U.S. Navy. And after I'd gotten a paragraph further, I stopped and I went back and I went, 1974. That was inside of 2 years of the end of combat operations in Vietnam. The Soviet Union was continuing to rise in their capabilities and numbers as a naval power. And, you know, here we find ourselves at the end of 2021, ending up a lot of our interest in land wars in Asia, so to speak, and we're facing a rising naval power as well. And I guess just to kind of kick things off, everybody wants to talk about Mahan and other periods of time when even in our living memory, there might be writing such as that from Vice Admiral Turner that might be worthy of a second look. You know, for the listeners, you know, take us back to 1974 and what you found so prescient, if not prescient, at least applicable to our time, but that article?
Well, you have to understand at the time, Turner was president of the Naval War College. And so he was sent there to revitalize the college, which he did. He installed essentially the curriculum that it has today, a very, very rigorous one. But the Navy was, like the other services, was trying to get itself revitalized after Vietnam. The Army eventually developed air land battle, Air Force with General Creech. Everybody went through a revitalization process after Vietnam, and Zumwalt eventually was CNO. Everybody's trying to revitalize, and so Turner, for his part, is trying to revitalize thinking in the U.S. Navy, and so he wrote that article trying to clarify the missions to give the Navy a set of terms and concepts which it could move forward with. Remember, the Soviet Navy at the time was a growing Navy, kind of like China is now. We didn't know what their intent was. I had been in the middle of that standoff between the U.S. and Soviet fleets in the Eastern Med in 73. So what Turner was trying to do was give the Navy a set of terms that would clarify decision-making in terms of how to design the fleet, strategic concepts, et cetera. So that's where he came up with the missions of sea control, power projection, presence, and strategic deterrence.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the difference between presence and, well, I guess it's a combination of roles. I mean, we've got sea control, which is what Admiral Turner talked about. We've got command of the sea, which is something I think completely different, but maybe control of the sea is a subset. And then we've got this presence mission. Can you kind of explain for me how those things kind of tie together?
Yeah, we have to go back to command of the sea first. That is a strategic global concept in which and you can call it maritime superiority, naval superiority, whatever you want, but it's a relationship between the strongest Navy and the next strongest Navy, which the difference in power is such that the second strongest Navy dares not send out its fleet to directly contest the matter with the strongest fleet. Therefore, the strongest fleet is at liberty to move its army across the seas, to protect its trade, to do all the kinds of things with the sea that you want to do, whereas the weaker Navy without command, to quote Mahan, only appears as a fugitive on the ocean. So you start with command of the sea. With command, you can thus distribute your forces or disperse your forces to do sea control in specific instances, like protect convoys, to defend beachheads, things like that. That's sea control, which is a function. It's not control of a piece of water. It's a function of things, whether it's convoys or landing beaches or whatever. Now, in command of the sea, there was a study done by two guys, Modelsky and Thompson, back in 1989, where they looked at the last 500 years of the exercise of sea power. And what they found were these long cycles where there would be a global war among the contenders for global leadership, whether it was the Netherlands, Britain, France, Germany, whoever. And one nation would prevail at sea. They would, through battle, they would seize command of the sea. And then eventually they'd win the war. Then in the peace afterwards, the nation with command of the sea would disperse its navy to enforce a global order that was congenial to its interests. In other words, command of the sea wasn't just a wartime thing. It extended into peacetime. And you used your navy in peacetime to enforce the kind of world order you wanted. Ergo, presence. And so what the U.S. Navy is doing and has been doing since 1946 is exercising its command of the sea to maintain a world order, a liberal trading order, that the United States desires. So that, broadly speaking, is presence, naval presence. We're enforcing a world order that we desire, deterring enemies, doing all, you know, building relationships, alliance relationships, doing all those things to maintain the world order that we want. That's what presence is about. Now, specific instances, you know, it's, you've got deterrence, you've got humanitarian assistance, anti-piracy, you name it, all these things, but they all are part of the U.S. grand strategy of maintaining a global liberal trading order.
One of the interesting quotes when you brought up Modelsky and Thompson is, I wrote next to it, I was like, well, that's alarming, and it is, and I'll do a little quote here from your article right after you introduced Modelsky and Thompson. Quote, command of the sea was defined as concentration of naval power in which one nation possesses roughly 50% of the total relevant warships owned by all contending powers. When deconcentration, the more even distribution of naval power among contending nations, occurred, global war eventually followed, producing a new global leader having command of the sea. Then the cycle repeated, unquote. You mentioned in 1974 you were involved in that standoff in the Eastern Med, and you know, when I was a JO, I caught the tail end of the Cold War through Desert Storm and until the Soviet Union finally fell apart. So we kind of bookended that rise the last time we had a big challenge. But when you look at the graphs of what the People's Republic of China has built recently, from the Modelsky and Thompson construct there, we're at a pretty critical juncture when it comes to our naval power relative to contending powers. Is that a correct reading?
More or less, yeah. The question that remains now, let me first say, Modelsky and Thompson based their analysis on a count, ship by hull by hull count of major warships of the contending powers. And right now, I did my own little count, and when you talk about major warships that, you know, can go into blue water, we actually still are at the right at the 50% mark. So we can say we still have global command of the sea, but the trends are not good. The U.S. Navy is shrinking. The PLAN is growing. Russia is retooling their navy. So the trends are worrying. But I would say at this point, I am not sure counting hulls is the right way to define command of the sea because of the rise of the anti-ship missile and cyberspace. There's a whole complex of things that now may require us to define the basis for command of the sea in a way different than major warship hulls. I don't know. Research is required.
Well, I had that same kind of thought that in the days of that those guys looked at, a lot of that was sail. It was before we had strong air forces and the capabilities to use them to help control the sea. I know this is probably an anathema to most Navy officers that the Air Force could have a role in this, but it's important to think that they do. And you're right, the anti-ship missiles, both cruise and ballistic, changed the picture considerably. One of the things I took out of your article was that the COCOMs right now are driving the use of our warships on a demand basis. And both you and Mr. Work seem to think that it would be useful, maybe more useful, if someone else got to say to the COCOMs, your demand is exceeding our capability to supply it and maintain and train our ships and crews, but you can have, you know, X instead of the Y that you've demanded. Can you kind of go into how that, the difference between the decisions made by the COCOMs and the national grand strategy of the use of our fleet would come into play?
Yeah, the current unified command plan, you know, was established by the National Security Act in 1947 and, you know, modified sequentially or subsequently by Goldwater Nichols. But when the Navy had a lot of ships, say 400 or 500 ships, the delegation of strategy to the individual regional COCOMs was not a problem. You know, we covered the world and we had plenty to do it. As the Navy has shrunk, the COCOMs have their own responsibilities, and they always react responsibly to their own responsibilities. In other words, their requests for naval forces are not frivolous. They, you know, based on their strategy, their theater security cooperation plans, they're only asking for what they feel they need. The problem is, and this is kind of an acid test, you ask yourself, who decides why those naval forces are deploying, the why of it? Well, right now, in the way it has been, the why is defined by the COCOMs. The Navy doesn't do that why, or it's not supposed to. All it does is raise, train, and equip, all right? In the middle, between providing forces and their use at the local regional level, there is a gap. Where is the global strategy for using naval forces? And it's not just a matter of concentration of force at a decisive point. It is a matter of who decides how they're, what they're deploying for. And there is a gap. The COCOMs decide, and that's problematic. When you had a lot of ships, that kind of got covered over. It didn't matter. But now that we're short on ships and we have another global competitor, that gap matters. There needs to be a global strategy for dealing with China and Russia, and there needs to be, as a subset of that overall global strategy, there needs to be a global maritime strategy for figuring out where to put our chips, as it were, in what areas, vice other areas. Because right now, the only thing that's happening is there is a Global Force Management Council, but all they're doing is distributing scarcity. They're not, you know, it's not strategic. Bob Work, as former Deputy Secretary of Defense, tried to establish a supply side process for, you know, the COCOMs, where you only get what the Navy can supply sustainably. But that didn't work because of that gap in the middle, that strategic gap between the force provider, the Navy, and the force users, the COCOMs, which is why I recommended that there be a staff inside DOD that does that.
You know, one thing that's come up on a regular basis in the years we've done MIDRATs is three things. One is the warping effects of the COCOMs. I sometimes look at them as competing salesmen. You know, everything's the most important, everything's the best, everything's the most critical, and they're all trying to get one buyer to give them what they have. And the 1986 Goldwater Nichols, built back at the height of the Cold War, and also the fact that our Chief of Naval Operations is, in many regards, in some ways that you outlined quite well in the article, sidelined. You know, you're raising, training, and equipping, but other people are putting the demands and stretching the forces, and he's kind of out of the loop in some regards. Now, for the first two, and I think to a degree, and I'm not an expert on this, in the third, for the COCOMs and Goldwater Nichols, that's going to require action in Congress. And I know there are some few people up on the Hill in both the House and the Senate who are interested in this, but there's not a critical mass yet. And in the likely event we can't get something to replace Goldwater Nichols, if the argument can be made that it's no longer fit for purpose, is there something that we could do with the roles and responsibilities of the Chief of Naval Operations, perhaps that additional department inside of DOD, that could better optimize kind of the unique requirements of maintaining the capability and the readiness of a naval force compared to other parts in DOD?
Yeah, anytime you try to go into the legislation, you start muddying the waters and incurring risks. Again, Bob Work and I talked about this, and what I came up with was this idea of creating a staff inside the Office of Secretary of Defense, because the joint you can't do it at the joint staff, because the joint staff doesn't have command authority. They can't tell people to go there, shoot them. That goes directly from the SecDef to the COCOMs. The Navy, of course, doesn't have that authority either. Where the authority lies, is with the Secretary of Defense. So that to solve the problem quickly without having to go into legislation or a total reorganization is to establish a staff within the Office of the Secretary of Defense. It can be an operational staff. They can direct naval forces. They have authority equal to the COCOM, so they can tell people no. They could.
I mean, the Navy has tried a number of things, like the fleet, the Fleet Readiness Plan or whatever it was, where we were, and then the thing that General Mattis, when he was Secretary of Defense, was trying, where we would have these surges, kind of on-demand surges that happened a couple of times. But all that seems to have fallen by the wayside, and we're stuck with this current situation. And you know, maybe the solution is a grand staff, but I'm always curious about what happens when you have such whether the force is going to think that that's another one of these layers that they don't need to deal with, or if that's a workable concept. And I guess I'm kind of asking that of you. I mean, have you talked to anybody about whether it just looks like another layer of admin in the middle of stuff, or is it a viable concept, do you think?
Well, again, Bob Work, who was Deputy Secretary of Defense, and I have talked this over quite a bit. And from his perspective, something like this could work. Would it be regarded as another layer? Well, you know, you run into the kind of the STRATCOM thing where they control certain things that are actually out in the operating in the COCOM regions. I think we've got enough experience with that in Special Operations Command and Transportation Command I think that it could be worked out. The experiences with those functional commands, I think, would allow us to establish a staff, and maybe we have to call it a command, but call it what you want, a global maritime command or whatever, to distribute naval forces. They, you know, once the forces are distributed, they would then be allocated or assigned to the COCOMs to be used not only as the COCOM desires, but in accordance with some national strategy too. But I don't think it would be another layer.
Now, equally complicated, if you're looking inside of our present funding construct, because it's hard to find any momentum one way or another. With all the spending we've seen in the last year, I mean, it's clear that we're not fiscally constrained to spend more on our Navy, but more priority constrained. It's just simply not a priority, and that's a reality. And early on in the article, you talked about four options with dealing with part of the problem of what we have. And you know, we just got through talking about your final option, which is centrally managing our Navy's from the Pentagon. And the third option is something that would be interesting that you could do almost in parallel with the other ones. And this is this argument's been going on since I think Jefferson was president. But that's, building if presence is important and presence is an ongoing naval mission and we don't have enough ships in our present funding to do what we need to be done is another answer, part of building more smaller, less expensive ships that might not be the perfect warship on the high-end fight, but are better able to perform the presence mission that you need in order to deter war. Is that third option one that you think is a spent argument, or are there some advocates out there that are maybe getting some traction where we could join in that part of the conversation again with some vigor that we saw, almost a decade ago?
Yeah, well, of course, I've written a number of articles advocating just that, forward flotillas. The Navy, if you look at the CNO NAV plan that came out at the end of last year, I guess it was, kind of do it, but it's mostly in the realm of unmanned vehicles. In other words, they're trying to proliferate platforms by developing unmanned systems. And I that has its place, and it's a step forward. But I do think you need manned platforms. And will the new frigate do that? I don't know. I don't think we can buy enough of them to really get that done, but maybe. But Admiral Joe Sestak, he's retired admiral and a former congressman, wrote an article in the Texas National Security Review a while back. I don't agree with all, but he asserted that, well, we've already lost command of the sea because we're only in the South China Sea at China's sufferance. Well, I don't necessarily agree with that, but he has a good point. Let's go back to command of the sea. It consists of two parts: maintenance of command, in other words, keeping that concentration of force, or keep, broadly speaking, our maritime superiority that nobody wants to challenge. And then the exercise. Now, for the United States, isolated as we are by the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, exercise of command and maintenance of command are really separated by these oceans. In other words, our home fleet, as it were, all the ships that are in home waters undergoing repair or training and everything, that constitutes the bulk of the Navy. It's, even now we generally have about 100 ships forward deployed with another 180 or so in home waters. So, our dynamic has always been the forward fleets kind of are the first responders and maybe the tripwires, but then we surge forward these naval forces from home waters that are surgeable. Well, Sestak contends that that is no longer viable. Things happen too fast forward, and our surge forces get forward, there'll be a fait accompli that we can't undo. Therefore, he thinks that we need kind of war-winning naval power stationed forward. If you buy that argument, and I kind of do, then you need these powerful flotillas, not gazillion aircraft carriers or Burks, but missile-based flotillas forward that can clearly able to defeat or at least strategically disrupt any attempt by China or Russia to conduct aggression via the sea. If you do that, then maintenance of command and exercise of command kind of become melded into one thing. We have powerful war-winning forces forward at all times, but these forces aren't big, expensive ships. There'll be some of them because there are reasons we need aircraft carriers, but mostly they're going to be missile carriers, and they can be cheap converted missile or merchant hulls, whatever, but just lots of missiles that can and a command and control system that can empower those missiles to get to their targets, then that is both combat readiness and forward presence and showing the flag all wrapped up into one. That's where we should go, I believe. I think that it's feasible for the Navy to get there, but I don't know that the Navy is ready to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's. I keep thinking when people discuss the use of some of these things like LCSs and fairly light ships to provide, quote, a presence, I keep thinking of our Asiatic fleet at the start of World War II. I mean, it was not a powerful enough fleet to accomplish whatever its goal was, and I'm not sure we knew what the goal was, but. It doesn't strike me that was a really smart way to do it. And I don't always agree with Admiral Sisdak about a lot of stuff, but I think the concept that you just laid out of missile toters, missile carriers, missile barges, I mean, things that the Navy has discussed. And we had I can't remember his name, but we had one of the officers, Pete Small, I think, from the unmanned surface craft group to come on and talk about some of the aspects of things that they're kind of working on, which I took to include unmanned missile escort vessels, sort of like the aviators have with their smart, whatever they're
wingman concept. Yeah.
Loyal wingman concept. You know, you get more bullets out there, and however you do it, that's great. The underlying questions is how well are we reading what the in this case the Chinese strategic goals are? Are they just trying to be a regional hegemon? Do we see that they're? What is their long term interest that we could look at and say, well, you know, this is the thing we need to worry about most. And when we look into our own national grand strategy, and I'm sitting here making notes, so excuse me while I'm, you know, why are in your Pentagon group there or your Department of Defense group that would handle this grand strategy? And I noticed you said in your article about the Air Force being involved, but why wouldn't we have every service involved to help sort out? You know, we don't need to replicate this, you know, we don't need to replicate Army programs in a Marine Corps and all that. Is that part of the function of that Grand Strategic Group, and how related to that is to what I just asked about the Chinese intentions?
Well, first of all, logically, you could bring in a whole bunch of stuff, create a true general staff here. I'm trying to put a Band-Aid over an immediate Navy problem, but... if you think about it, yes, then a centrally managed strategic staff would necessarily have to be interagency, all the services joint, you name it, to oversee the development of a comprehensive national grand strategy for security and then execute it. Obviously, but I haven't been trying to do that. I mean, that kind of thing would be good, I guess, but, you know, the problem, our whole system is predicated on distrust of a military guy with too much power. We don't want to rest the total power of the military in some one officer's hands. That's always been the case. Ergo, you have a civilian Secretary of Defense. Now, clearly, that Secretary of Defense, there could be the Deputy Secretary of Defense or something like that could be the, quote, commander, unquote, of that staff. But it is a much different approach to global national security than we've had in the past. So that would be you know, for my part, I'm just trying to Band-Aid the Navy's problem.
Does a lot of this just simply derive from the fact that in the construct that we have right now between the roles and responsibilities of the CNO and the COCOMs and the joint staff, that there, a gap has been created where the, I don't know if unique is the right word, but particular requirements that it takes to maintain over the long term a naval force, that that's been lost somewhere, and that the short-term focus of the COCOMs and their desires and their needs is there's no countervailing force, i.e. the right people aren't in the SecDef jobs who understand it, that are willing to fill that gap. Is this where these problems keep deriving from, is the fact that our structure simply does not account for that?
Right. That's right. Not to get too metaphysical, but our unified command plan takes no account of a single world ocean. The way the unified command plan is structured, the oceans are comm zones between CONUS and the forward areas around ringing Eurasia. From time to time, there crop up problems, security problems, that necessarily are related to a single world ocean. The 1980s maritime strategy was a case in which the Navy kind of stepped outside its box and engaged in global maritime strategy, developing global maritime strategy. It worked as best it could through the COCOMs and everything and obeyed the law, but the idea, the concept of coordinating the deployment and use of naval forces among the COCOMs originated with Admiral Hayward when he was out in Seventh Fleet, but then he became CNO, and that idea kind of took root in the Navy, and eventually its manifestation was the maritime strategy of the 1980s. The second case where a global maritime problem that could not be dealt with by our UCP was in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, the Navy and the Coast Guard had to somehow achieve maritime security for the nation to protect the shore so that terrorists couldn't smuggle or mount an attack on the U.S., a 9/11 style attack, from the sea. And I was part of that. And the problem was, as we war gamed our way through this thing time after time, we finally figured out you couldn't patrol our coasts. You couldn't actually even develop a defense in depth starting at the far shore and going across the oceans and finally in close, kind of a scale up of the Navy's tactical defense scheme. None of that worked, and the Allies weren't buying in. And of course, at the time, we were not everybody's favorite because of the Iraq invasion. So we had to, what we realized was that the only way to secure our shores was to secure all the oceans of the world. All right? That's not a multi-regional thing. That is a single global ocean thing. And so what the Navy did was went about courting international naval cooperation for maritime security. And we did that by kind of arrogating onto ourselves the ability to make statements about national policy. And that's what you see in the CS-21. We said that we're strategically defensive. We deploy our forces to defend the system. I outright forbid any talk of globalization, supporting globalization or anything like that, because I didn't want us to seem offensive in any possible way. We CS-21 was a statement of the United States adopting a strategically defensive posture to allay the distrust of nations around the world. And sure enough, it worked. In the aftermath of publishing CS-21, the amount of international maritime security cooperation mushroomed. All right, so the 80s maritime strategy and CS-21 were examples of the Navy stepping outside its box, at least slightly, to solve a global single ocean maritime problem. So it will do that when it's necessary.
Well, when I started reading your article, I thought, well, this is really about what happens when your fleet is too small to have command of the sea the way we used to have it. I mean, when I joined the fleet back in toward the end of the Vietnam War, I think we had 750 ships or something. None of them were all, you know, super capable ships, but we had that many things afloat. And we're so much smaller now, although individual ships are somewhat more capable. They can still only control a certain amount of water at any given moment. And I note that early on in your piece, you talk about how you don't think Congress will fund the additional shipping that would warship building that we would need. And I think that's one of the reasons when we start looking at these unmanned ships, they do cost a lot less. Can you kind of explore that point a little bit about why? I mean, can we build our way out of this problem using unmanned or smaller capable ships? And if so, who would be in charge of deploying those things? I mean, we still have the same issues of training and manning and readiness and maintenance of the ships.
Right. I think it's possible, especially if we resort to converting merchant hulls to missile carriers, not as our total frontline units, but if you use them just to augment the overall force combat power. And that's a problem with the Navy that I've fought for years, is the Navy tends to think ship by ship. And we really should be thinking force level, fleet level power, which is hard to do when your fleet is composed of discrete carrier battle groups and that's your total offense. If we get away from the carrier battle group as our primary offense capability and go to missiles, now we can start looking beyond individual platforms to the total 7th fleet or the total 5th fleet and build that force into a lethal unit that in which individual pieces of it are not expendable, but the loss of any individual unit doesn't wreck the whole thing or doesn't take away 30% of your combat power in one fell swoop. Some of that can be unmanned, certainly, but quite a bit of it has to be manned. And maybe it's frigates, maybe it's some kind of glorified LCS, I don't know, but you want a lot of them. You know, if I can't build two frigates for the cost, at least two frigates for the cost of a Burke, then that's the wrong design. Maybe we have, you know, what are Burks now, $1.6 billion, something like that. What can we buy four of for $1.6 billion? And it's not LCSs either, but we ought to be able to figure out some kind of ship that we can build four of for $1.6 billion and that they're lethal because they carry missiles. It's the missiles that constitute the lethality. So I think it's possible to build a numerous Navy if we just get off the carrier battle group is our offense, and we got to have Burks and Tycos, stuff like that, to defend the carrier battle group, and get on to let's build a bunch of ships that have some seakeeping capability but carry missiles. Then you can do other things with them too, but that's where I think we have the potential for getting to the kind of fleet we need within the budgets that we're projected to have.
Yeah, it's always a fun conversation to have with people on the policy side, usually the civilian types that talk about doing X or Y, and the right after trying to explain to him the fact that the underwater environment is not constant and there is topography there, the second most entertaining thing to do is say, okay, let's count VLS cells and let's count what are in those VLS cells and let's do comparisons on one thing or the other. One thing you mentioned earlier, and when you answered the last question, it just came back up again, and I wanted to bounce this off of you because when we're in a kind of a pickle, in whatever circumstance you are, it's kind of human nature to look for easy explanations, convenient answers to hard questions. And when it comes to the present mission, you will occasionally hear people talk about the, we can do presence missions with large unmanned surface vessels to be determined of capability down the road, or even with submarines. Besides having four of your SSGNs surface on one day and waving the flag, that doesn't have a great history of using submarines for a presence mission. And with the international standard of having no consequence to either capture or hijacked unmanned vessels, which we've seen both the Chinese and the Iranians do, is there a danger of letting the argument that you can do the presence mission with unmanned systems, how much of a danger does that happen, or does that really not have as much leg room as in the most serious circles as it appears in open source when that topic comes up?
Well, in my view, it is a role that unmanned systems have in presence, or in my terminology, the exercise of command to maintain a favorable world order, is going to be very narrow and limited, rightly understood. They're not a jack of all trades, regardless, because they're unmanned. You're going to need manned ships for the foreseeable future for the exercise of command, for that presence mission. Where unmanned systems might help is in surveillance and, some narrow areas of deterrence. They could be used. But by and large, in my view, it's going to require sailors on ships operating forward. What those ships are is, and I actually don't even like to say the word ships, but what kind of force, naval force, do we need at various points to execute our global strategy of maintaining, of defending the system that we have put in place, whose purpose, by the way, originally was to avert a World War III. And if that's the fundamental purpose of our global system, then we better not spot somebody or let our command of the sea erode, because over five cycles of history since 1497, eroding command of the sea, while not causing a global war, certainly is associated with the march to a global war.
I've been listening to I'm late to this book, obviously, but it's a book called New Rules of War by Sean McFate. And he challenges a lot of the conventional thinking about how we should develop our military. And I think a lot of those concepts, I think you just touched on one of them, which is the carrier battle group, which we've now created, doesn't have the range to get inside the missile threat zone. The aircraft don't have the range to get inside the missile threat zone without more. And some of what we've, what he is concerned about is we'll have this magic thinking, if we have these unmanned vessels that'll magically solve some of our problems. Are you familiar with his work, and do you have any thoughts on the kind of, I think you wisely use the word force instead of ships to, any additional thoughts on that you'd like to talk about right now?
Well, I'm not familiar directly with his work, although what you've said about it, if you look back into the transformation era you know, from the late 90s through the early 2000s, you know, that was full of magical thinking. Even, you know, Bob Work, he talks about offsets, the third offset. Even that gets me a little nervous. You know, you're trying to find some kind of magical leverage. And I don't have time to go into it here, but I've and I haven't published this, but I've developed a theory of the forms of warfare, which is logistic warfare, where you're just trying to steamroll the enemy and you've got superior logistics and forces and everything, like Grant did to Lee or we did to Hitler in Europe. Then the next form of warfare down is what I call heroic warfare, where you're using generals of genius with, you know, crack troops to outmaneuver and checkmate the enemy. And that's, of course, what we did with air-land battle and that whole military that crushed Saddam. That's all well and good, and that certainly is something we would like to have, but I don't think you can, you know, that's got a limited shelf life. Other people adapt, and so your ability to outmaneuver and checkmate somebody is always questionable. You know, Lee crushed Hooker at Chancellorsville, but that didn't stop Lincoln. You know, he kept fighting, you know, the Japanese destroying our battleships at Pearl Harbor didn't cow us. We went on to clean their clock. So there's the ability to checkmate somebody is real iffy. The third form of warfare, by the way, is disruptive, which is like guerrilla warfare. It's the strongest form of warfare because the weakest choose it. Heroic warfare is the resort of the weaker party, too. Only the very strongest can do systematic warfare or logistics warfare, which is the best kind if you're strong enough to use it. But at any rate, talking about unmanned systems or as a panacea, technologies that can, you know, serve as an offset is dangerous thinking in my book. You just need to be strong.
Your strength is one of those things that is quickly discovered when it's lacking and makes a point when it's exercised early and with vigor. With your background in wargaming, I wanted to roll this way to you as well, because just like you know, everybody, nobody wants to really dive into the logistics part because it's not as fun, I guess, is when it comes to a possible conflict over Taiwan, everybody loves to wargame how they would fight that battle out. But you brought up something that I thought brought out in quick relief that what would be really interesting to war game and is important to do, because one of them is going to happen one way or another if it takes place, is you outlined the fact that the outcome of any battle over Taiwan is going to be a really decisive point in the larger scheme of what our two nations are going to do. And whether there is an unsuccessful invasion, whether China is succeeding, or win or lose, what's happening afterwards is going to have huge implications. Outline, you know, real fast your thoughts on the after conflict part of an unsuccessful, a successful, or either way of a conflict over Taiwan.
Well, let's start with unsuccessful. I think it's. I had an interesting discussion a number of years ago with a PLA colonel, a guy named Lam Bao Sung, very smart, cool guy. And we were talking about network-centric warfare and this, that, and the other thing. And, well, we finally got around to Taiwan. And he made the statement. He tried to argue by analogy, if Alaska seceded, wouldn't you use force to bring it back in? And that was a bad analogy. I said, I use Puerto Rico. They routinely vote on whether to be independent or not. We'd say good riddance to you. But he then said, if the Chinese Communist Party does not succeed in recovering Taiwan, China will fall apart. because our legitimacy is based on our promise to fully and finally reunite China. Now, there's holes in that, but if he's right, and I don't know if he was firing for effect, using information warfare or whatever, but let's take it at face value. An unsuccessful invasion of Taiwan could bring at least bring down the Xi or whoever's the president at the time and is replaced by some other element within the Chinese Communist Party leadership that says, well, it wasn't our idea, and they back off. And that might happen, or China might fall apart. I don't know. But certainly an unsuccessful invasion probably constitutes an existential problem for whoever's leading it and whoever pressed the go button. What if they're successful? My fear is that if they are successful and the U.S. is unable or doesn't try to stop it, our credibility as a world leader starts falling apart. And then, you know, there's kind of a domino effect where other nations say, well, we're going to jump on the Chinese bandwagon for one way or another. On the other hand, and this, you know, who knows, but on the other hand, such an invasion might coalesce everybody else and say, okay, China's a danger. We all got to cooperate more closely against them. And, you know, the Belt and Road Initiative starts withering. China's economy starts going to hell. So, you know, it's hard to say which way that's going to go if they are successful with Taiwan. But I think at a bare minimum, depending on how that goes, whether if, you know, if we lose half our Navy in trying to unsuccessfully defend Taiwan, we've committed a strategic error, because one of the principles is don't risk your maintenance of command of the sea by exercising in instances of exercising it. And defending Taiwan would be an instance of exercising command of the sea. So, you know, where that goes, it could go either way.
Well, on that encouraging note, Bernie,
it's a dangerous world, and you know, here's my bottom line. If the United States wants to be a global leader, then it, by God, better invest accordingly. It can't remain global leader on a shoestring. If it does, it will cease to be a global leader.
That's an excellent point to make, and if you. I want to thank you for coming on the show today, and if you have anything that's coming up in the future you'd like to tell our listeners about, this would be a good time to do it.
Well, the only thing I got is on the 8th, I'm going to be in Washington at a Naval Institute forum on sea power, and I'll be talking much the same stuff, although that's not going to be broadcast or anything. The Naval Institute may make available transcripts or something, I don't know, but it sounds like it's going to be interesting.
Well, Barney, once again, I really appreciate you taking some time today to join us for another edition of NIDRAT, and we look forward to the opportunity to talk to you again in the future.
You bet. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us today on NIDRAT. Until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be too